water concerns in the NT and a Brisbane murder charge. Hello, I'm Stephen Clark with the National Indigenous News. A Beetaloo Basin traditional owner is concerned by a proposed backdoor to the federal government's water trigger bill.
Well, if the federal government pass on this water trigger to the NT government, it will cause a catastrophic event. We don't want another Murray-Darling disaster, and we don't want our icons, Delhi Rivers and Roper Rivers, drained out, or our underground aquifer damaged. What people are going to live, if fracking poison our water, then cattle station, farmers, tourists, and country and sacred site will suffer. Everyone will lose, both in the Northern Territory and across Australia.
That's Jingoli Elder Samuel Sandy speaking to NERS News. The draft national environmental laws would allow state and territory governments to make decisions about major coal mining and unconventional gas projects that impact water resources. Currently, it's the federal government's responsibility to manage those projects. A man has been charged with the murder of a 66-year-old woman found dead in a Brisbane unit. Police and paramedics were called to a Fortitude Valley unit for a welfare check yesterday afternoon. Police said they had to force their way into the unit where they found the body of the Western Australian woman. A 42-year-old man who was related to the woman was arrested at the unit and later charged with one count of murder. He's due to appear in court today. Taiwan has been rocked by a 7.5 magnitude earthquake. Taiwanese media shows collapsed buildings and the island-wide train service has been suspended. A tsunami warning's been issued for southern Japan, with the country's meteorological agency warning the quake could trigger waves as high as 3 metres in some areas of Okinawa. The Alice Springs youth curfew is set to end next week, but the Northern Territory Chief Minister has already said it may be extended. Eva Lawler brought in the curfew last week in response to civil unrest in the central Australian town, banning all children under 18 from the CBD from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. The controversial curfew may face legal challenges, and the Northern Territory Police Association has said it has been told the measure may not be legal. Bess Price is the assistant principal at the Yiparinya School in Alice Springs and told the ABC the curfew has made a difference.
Some of our Aboriginal staff here, you know, would amazed at the difference the CBD area looked over the weekend, and they were pleased that it did take place. And even you know, it was nice and quiet because it made families take their families back out to communities as well for the weekend.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has announced a new Governor-General for the Commonwealth. Samantha Mostyn will succeed David Hurley on July 1. Ms Mostyn was the first woman to be appointed to the Australian Football League Commission, which is the AFL's governing body.
Australia will always be a stronger and more successful country when we draw on the skills and smarts of all of our citizens. This understanding has driven Sam's tireless advocacy for gender equality, particularly in the world of business, for women's safety and for reconciliation.
The New South Wales Premier will pitch controversial new bail laws to regional areas today. The state's been experiencing a surge in violent robberies, break-ins and car thefts across its regional centres. Premier Chris Minns says the new bail laws and a suite of regional crime measures will help curb rising crime in country areas. The laws will make it harder for young people to get out on bail. The New South Wales government has been deeply criticised by Indigenous groups, which say it'll disproportionately impact Indigenous young people. Last year, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children made up more than half of the average daily number of young people in custody. We'll have more after this.
It's round four of the 2024 AFL Premiership season for AFL Indigenous Broadcasting. Friday from 4:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Saving Time, the Brisbane Lions take on North Melbourne live from Garner Lands at Norwood Oval. And on Sunday from 4:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time, Collingwood take on Hawthorn live from Garner Lands at Adelaide Oval. Broadcast throughout the nation by the National Indigenous Radio Service.
And that's the latest National Indigenous News.
Ted Wilkes from Perth, I'm a Noongar man.
What up, it's your brother man Zimbla, and you are listening to
the National Indigenous Radio Service.
The voices of our people.
For our children, we all walk together to keep our children safe, strong and connected to culture. Community organisations you trust are here to walk with you and can provide family wellbeing services for families and children of all ages. To find free and confidential support near you, search Family Wellbeing Services. Because when it comes to our children, we all walk together. Authorised by the Queensland Government, Brisbane.
Station sponsor.
When someone was sharing intimate images without my permission and threatening me online, I didn't know what to do. One of my aunties told me about the online safety laws and helped me report the abuse to esafety.gov.au. The laws help to keep people safe from severe online abuse and help to remove dangerous online content. Go to esafety.gov.au to learn more or to report online abuse. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
Station sponsor.
Hey, Bill and Gunn, and welcome to Blackmore Tribal Edition. Murimu here with you today as we broadcast, I think it's just the Passover weekend, or what the international world called Easter. The good news is that Christ died on the cross for the sins of the world and he rose again. And we celebrate that every day here on the Yidinji Territory because that's Gayabara, Gayabara in the flesh. And Gayabara Galanyundu means God's peace be upon you. And that's the original name for God here, the Yidinji title for God. And that's a very important thing when we talk about these things. Joining me today is Ganyara Yalmabara, the Attorney General, also the Minister for the Treasury for the Sovereign Yidinji Government. And like every week, we try to bring you a program to inform you of what's going on in the world of sovereignty and Indigenous rights and government and all that kind of stuff. Now, for those listening, there was a very important development happened recently, which we did discuss on this program. Of course, nationally, in terms of inside of Australia, The Voice got a bit of a beltdown, and it appears to be the case in South Australia as well, with the very low voter turnout and an overwhelming response to thanks but no thanks. And of course, the people at Sky News have made this presentation, and I think they're reveling in it. But let's have a listen to what they've got to say.
Now, embarrassment for Labor as the South Australian government's decision to push ahead with a state-based voice. We all voted against The Voice, but no, Labor, what's his name, thinks he knows better. It backfired. Just over 9% of Indigenous Australians in South Australia turned out to vote following a resounding no vote in the federal referendum. Joining us now to discuss this is South Australian Liberal member of the Legislative Council, Ben Hood. Ben, great to see you again. What is going on in South Australia? Please explain. We voted against The Voice, but you then do a voice and nobody bothers to turn up. You know, it's what if they, the old saying used to be, what if they put up on a war and nobody came? Or what if they actually legislated a voice and nobody bothered to turn up? What's going on, Ben?
Well, you're spot on, Rowan, and happy Easter Sunday to
you.
Your viewers. Look, what has happened is probably what we expected. 64% of South Australians voted no to the federal referendum, and now 90% of Aboriginal South Australians have, for all intents and purposes, turned their back on this voice. It's a vote of no confidence. There was approximately 2,500 votes cast throughout the state. And some electors or some nominators were elected with less than six votes. And there are cases that some of them had zero vote. So it begs the question, did they even come out and vote for themselves? It's it's an absolute travesty. It's a complete failure on every measure. And Peter Malinauskas needs to undo this straight away, no doubt about it.
Rita.
Wow. Yeah, well, it was reported there were reps elected with six votes, which is mind-blowing. But we've also seen this in Victoria. Now, Victoria had less than 10% turnout as well, 7%, and just under 10% for the last First People's Assembly, they call it in Victoria. But there seems to be no appetite to do a U-turn here. What will the Liberals, the Coalition, do if they are elected? Do you have a firm policy to roll this back, or are we waiting and seeing what happens?
Look, it's a great question, Rita. And look, I've personally been against the federal vote and, of course, the state vote as well. And as long as I'm in the party room of the state Liberals, I'll be advocating for a repeal policy to be brought to 2026. But at the end of the day, we have a repeal bill being brought before the Legislative Council by the Honourable Sarah Game. I congratulate her on that. But it hasn't been brought to a vote because we don't have the numbers, quite simply. So it is up to Peter Malinauskas to pull the levers of government to undo what has essentially been a failed ideological experiment on behalf of Labor and put a line through this voice. Only yesterday, the Premier and Attorney General Khaya Ma equated this vote, this successful vote in their terms, to ATSI. And we know exactly how ATSI turned out. It was abolished because of corruption and nepotism. And I'm really worried, as are a majority of South Australians, I think, that that's exactly where this state voice is going to go as well.
James.
Well, Ben, tell me about, you've got a petition, don'tdividesa.com.au. Tell me how that's going, what that's calling for. And is it true that you've had more signatories to that petition than people actually cast their vote in this election?
Well, James, that's exactly right. Don't Divide SA is a petition that I spun up last November. To date, we've had over 7,000 votes signs, a signatory on that petition. So that's about, I'm not very good at maths, but about 171% more than the people that actually voted in this state voice. And I think that outlines the issue here, that the Labor government in South Australia are ignoring the pleas of everyday South Australians. They're not focused on cost of living. They're not focused on dealing with the energy crisis. They're not focused on small business and backing the family, but chasing down every ideological rabbit hole with their pet causes. And unfortunately, they're the ones that have to undo this.
And Ben, sorry, just one more question for you. How much will this voice cost to operate, run, implement? And what actual authority does it have, if any, to influence legislation? Or is this just simply an expensive advisory body that has no power, or that it will have power and have real teeth despite having representatives voted onto it with tiny, tiny, less than a handful of votes?
Look, it's a great question, James. At the end of the day, Labor would have you believe both, that it's this powerful voice for Aboriginal Australians, or it's actually not anything really that terrible. What it is the voice can come onto the floor of Parliament and speak to any bill. The clerks of both houses have to advise the voice of any legislation, any bill that comes before Parliament. Now, they can't hold it up, but as we know with the federal voice, and this was the argument, that when the voice will go against a bill from any government, essentially any government that will go against the voice will probably be deemed inherently racist, and they will play it out in the media. It is going to be a handbrake on our democracy, and at the end of the day, we should not delineate our democracy on race. It is simple as that.
But Ben, it's not a handbrake on your democracy, it's the death of your democracy. You do not have democracy in South Australia. If some person with six votes or 11 votes or whatever it is can go onto the floor of Parliament and their opinion can sway legislation that the democratically elected and overrule, if you like, or influence the democratically elected body. It is the death of democracy. There is absolutely no place in a democracy for this sort of cronyism, and it must be repealed. And Peter Malinauskas, what you have done is shown that Labor's entire Indigenous First Nations voice program is a complete farce. It's a complete joke. You do not represent the Indigenous people of this country. They voted against you, Labor. Learn the lesson. Ben Hood, thanks so much for coming on Outsiders. Have a great Easter, and please get rid of this ridiculous thing out of the South Australian Parliament as soon as you get into power.
Well, there you have it. Sky News at it again. Ganyara, the people have spoken, and no one, Labor's done another dropped the ball on this one again, they've claimed. But, you know, maybe there is no remedy in this voice, state-based voices. We know now that federally it's a dog with fleas, and now in South Australia at least it's a dog with fleas. And in Victoria, the opposition said they're not going to support the treaty. So what is the solution? And, of course, we know that.
Geez, I'm glad someone asked. You know, this is the rather strange world we live in, because the Yidinji Nation seems to be like a bunch of lepers. In the academic world of Australia, they just don't want to know, but a few actually. I shouldn't say all Australians, because there are a few that know the truth. They know the absolute fact of what Yidinji is, but it's the political will. You know, there isn't much of a political appetite for the Indigenous sovereignty stuff at present, because last year the voice, the referendum to all of that, it presented what Australia really believed and what they really think, and, you know, it was a failure. Just like the state one in South Australia, the state voice. How can there be remedy inside Australia? I've got to ask people that. How can there be remedy inside Australia when your sovereignty is acknowledged as coexisting with the sovereignty of the Australian Crown? Coexisting means separate from, and but at the same time it's there, you know, it's separate. It can't be the same thing. So the remedy can't be inside Australia. It can't be a state-based voice. Why should Aboriginal South Australians have more of a say over anything than the Chinese South Australians or the British South Australians? You know, we're talking about racial profile now of a citizen. Now, the citizen, it doesn't matter where the human comes from to their ancestry to be a citizen of Australia. The citizen of Australia is created pursuant to the Australian Constitution. And they go, oh, yeah, no, it's the Birth, Death and Marriages Act. Well, yeah, well, the Birth, Death and Marriages Act of a state is subject to the Australian Constitution. The states are created by the Australian Constitution. It is the Australian Constitution.
Yeah, and look, you know, I often hear that the letters patent in South Australia and that there was this, that and the other with the Aboriginal people. Yes, that's true. But what needs to take place, in my view, and it has been a long-held view in this territory, is that the Indigenous South Australian, let's say the Aboriginal South Australian, is the only one that can go back to country and revitalise the law that isn't South Australian law. It could be Adjamantna law, it could be Kaurna law, it could be Ngarrindjeri law, it could be one of those laws. Revitalise it with your foundation of law, your expressions of sovereignty, your coats of arms, your governance structure, and have it as a mechanism where Australia can get true settlement and remedy, as you've mentioned.
Well, you mentioned that in South Australia, you know, especially with the voice vote. I think only 8.9% of the Aboriginal population turned out to vote on it. It was very low turnout. Why? Because they sort of have a hint that it's not going to work. It's not going to be worth two bob. It's useless. So they didn't go there. When you mentioned the Aboriginal people of South Australia, there was actually an interesting case a few years back, probably 8 or 9 years ago, something like that, with Walker versus the state, you know, down there. And it was over native title. It was over a native title argument. Now, the bloke that went in there was being seen legally through the South Australian identity. So it was an Australian citizen going in there to say the native title should be banned, should be cancelled, should be stopped. He said, under Aboriginal law, now the judge basically pulled him up and said, OK, hang on a sec. Under Aboriginal law, native title doesn't apply to you. If you're under your own Aboriginal law, you can't see native title. It's got nothing to do with you. You've got all your own titles pursuant to your law. But if you're going to be seen through a South Australian identity, native title is going to apply, and we'll apply the rules of how native title should be applied to all Australian citizens, not the tribe. I understand there's a very big difference there. He said, go back to your country. If you believe that you're sovereign, go back to your world, go back to your country and bring your laws into place and bring in your judiciary to make a decision on this matter.
Yeah, and I think the Boulogne Shire Council case that we've brought on this program a few times now is reminiscent of that. But the difference is they only want to see their world, and at this stage they can only see Australian law. So, yes, he can go back to it, but even if he did, there may be complications or mismatches.
He'll be invisible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what happened recently with our Chief Superintendent of Police. The courts couldn't legally recognise that person or that identity. And this is where I guess that it is... We've got to build it and they will come. There's no... cutting the corners short or there's no add water and instantly you've got sovereignty. This is a very, very arduous, long journey that we've been on for 10 years now, and I'll tell you now, every day is tough, but every day is rewarding because it's one step closer to the truth and becoming manifesting on this land, and that's a beautiful thing.
So what you're saying is the voice models just don't work. They just can't be a, here it is, here's the voice, and you're away with your sovereignty.
Look, it doesn't matter if it's ATSIC, the voice, DATSIP, they're all foreign constructs to talk about or trying to deal with something that's none of their business. And at the end of the day, they should be at least having private conversations with Yidinji in relation to this territory up here. I'm not speaking for anyone else in terms of outside of the territory. But, you know, seriously consider that, because what we are offering in terms of a nation, you mentioned remedy again, this is the only thing. It's one thing to point out the error at law. It's another thing to go the extra mile, as Jesus would say, to fix the problem for free. This is a very important thing, that charity. You know, in the book of Corinthians, it talks about faith, hope, and love. And love is the greatest of all these things. Who really loves this place? Who really wants to call this place home and loves it being here? Who loves blackfellas, who loves whitefellas, or whoever you are? That's where it's at.
It really is. And this is where, you know, the voice failed. It failed for a very fundamental reason. Because Australia is made for all Australians, Australian citizens. Black, white, brindle, don't care what your race is, what your ancestry is, an Australian citizen is created pursuant to the Australian Constitution. And the states are created subject to the Australian Constitution. So everything inside the Commonwealth of Australia, including all the states and all its citizens, form the Commonwealth of Australia. You are all equal under the Australian law. The reason they couldn't see the Aboriginal South Australia, or the South Australian Aboriginal at the time, because there is no treaty. The reason they couldn't see our copper was because there is no treaty in place to allow the Commonwealth of Australia to officially recognise our legal identities, the ones that we created pursuant to our sovereignty that coexist with the sovereignty of the Australian Crown. They can't see. That's why the need for a treaty. You know, we've been working on this for years with Australia to try and say, look, this is the remedy. If we're going to create a problem, we need to provide a solution for it. Otherwise, don't create the problem in the first place. Let the problem lie until a solution is made, and then you raise the issue of the problem, then issue the solution. The solution is not a state-based voice. It's not a federal-based voice. It's not a state-based treaty. The states aren't sovereign enough to treat. They aren't sovereign enough to do anything. You know, you can get these advisory bodies and call them a voice, call them whatever you like, but they're not going to be anything meaningful for the Aboriginal people in their true and correct capacity. Simple as that. So we've seen this. We've been offering it all along. And as you said, the remedy is there. We've been offering this for not one Australian dollar. Not one. We don't want Australian money, period. How about we give Australia some of our money, some of our wealth, our natural wealth, for example?
Yeah, I think that can be legitimised in terms of you don't have to steal our stuff anymore, steal your dingy stuff, that is. You know, everything here is, through the wisdom of the elders, can be shared equally. And that's quite a simple thing. You know, even the international community, Ganyara, when we talk about international lawyers of repute and professors at law and the College of Law at the ANU, they can see this. A guy called Matt Quartrip, who we've met, can also see this. I Want to Break Free is a practical guide to making a new country. It's 166 pages long, Manchester University Press publication. And I've had Matt on the program talking about this, and he's saying Yidinji's doing the right thing, basically. He's following the international norms of how to achieve statehood and to self-represent or be autonomous, whatever it is. And a majority of the world agree with the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. They also agree to decolonise or bring any manifestation of colonisation to a speedy end. So everything that Yidinji's doing is right. the further that Australia kicks the can down the road, it's going to hurt them more than it hurts us.
It sure is. And if you read that book, and it's worth a read, it really is worth a read, that book, he goes on to say to build a new country or to build a new nation or a new state is the hardest thing anyone can do. And I mean that. It is the hardest thing anyone can choose. You're better off trying to learn to fly, you know, without a plane. Just go and learn to fly. Just flap your arms. It'll be a lot easier than trying to build a nation. It really is. It's a hard thing. But in doing the right thing, because we've got to settle the past. We've got to sort this mess out. You know, Australia is a manifestation of colonialism. There is no two ways about it.
Just look at the flag. Well, Union Jack, top left-hand corner.
You mean that Union Jack? Oh, gee, where did that come from? I think that was British. Look, it is. It is the white Australia. It's still here. There is no argument about it. It's got the whole system. Even Queensland has acts in place that date back to 1600, British acts, that can be amended over there, which will have an impact here. So it is a manifestation of colonialism. There is no ifs, no buts about it. But we've got to sort that mess out. We've got to sort it out. They aren't going to sort it out. What can Australia offer us? We're the ones that hold the territory under our law. And this is the important part, under our law, not Australian law, native title. There was a really good determination that said native title gives you nothing. It really does. It's the way the Aboriginal people can prove ownership of their land. So it's the way that Australia can acknowledge that the Aboriginals own their land under their law. Mm. That's as simple as it gets. That's really all native title is. It gives you nothing because you already own the place. If you're the owner of the place, what are we going to do with all our boat people? You know, we've got 200,000 or 300,000 boat people on our territory. What are we going to do with them? We've got to look after them because they're all humans like us. The issue is their legal identity doesn't have the right to be here. The Australian identity doesn't have the right to be here yet on our territory. We create ourselves, we create our government to do this, to say, okay, Australia, we're going to let you be on our territory subject to a treaty. This is as simple as it gets. Subject to this treaty, you can be here and do what you've got to do and abide by the conditions of UNDRIP, as you mentioned, the United Nations Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People, Article 5. Go and read that. We've got the right to revitalise all our junk, bring back all our institutions, whatever it is, while we have the right to participate in the life of the state, if we so choose. If we don't, we look after ourselves. But what's that leave the role of Australia? They're in charge of the international stuff, the stuff that's outside our border, you know, on the neighbouring tribe, for example, to stop any conflict there, or with Japan when they're putting their radioactive water into the sea affecting us.
Yeah, who'd want to take on Russia with their missiles and their good go, not us, or anyone else, you know, like that's what I'm saying. We're not interested in that big end of the... that's serious stuff. And you know, I think the Yidinji Nation is very serious about defending its borders. That's not the issue here, but, I mean, to be fair, I have no interests in the international ongoings of those UN member states. It's really something that Australia should be doing, but legitimately, and that can only be done through a successfully concluded formal agreement with the Yidinji Nation on this territory. And if you can't get that, then someone else can going to get it.
Well, this is the dangerous part for Australia. They've got to sort of get this in their mind, and I know a few. I've been speaking with a few of the academics about this, and they said, you're right, you can do a treaty with whoever you like. No ifs, no buts about it. They can't argue that case. But we don't want to go there yet. We want to try and give Australia the best chance, because I speak English, you speak English. I can't speak Korean. I can't speak, you know, Persian. You know, so why do I want to go and bring in one of that where I've got to start to learn another language, you know? A bit long in the tooth for that at this stage. But let's give Australia a go, a fair go. They're doing all right in the big picture of things. They're doing okay. But they really do need to represent us at international law with our blessing, not just saying we are going to do it, we're going to force it on you. Mm. Simple.
You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the planet today, thanks to our friends at Bumabipra Media, who have consent to be on the Yidinji Territory to produce this broadcast. And a big thanks to Jackie, Trevor and Maddie and everyone else that's putting in the hard yards there at Bumabipra Media. But also, if you're listening inside of Australia, it's via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And we thank you, wherever you are listening to this program, and your elders and your mob for letting this program use your airspace. We'll be back after the break.
Too often I find my name in mouths of hungry men and mama's help. Open the greedy ends and they say sometimes my silence invites hunger in their eyes, mouths full of tears, learning why they feast with appetite to fear. And I know that I lose every fight I don't fight. Lay my words where you found them. Take a teeth out my tongue, I associate the taste of silence with my blood. Just the deep of these wounds, more than all of my years. History will not move when it's trapping you, when you're trapping it. Skin that's far deeper than these wounds, more than 200 years. History cannot move when it's trapped in you, when you're trapped in this skin that's holding the truth.
The Yidinji Nation is growing every day, and recently we created the Chamber of Culture, and earlier I spoke with Krishna Sangrapile, who is the president of the Chamber of Culture, to talk about what the culture is designed for, the Chamber of Culture that is, and I hope you enjoy this interview.
How did it come about? Really, it came about from the fact that we had gotten ourselves involved, myself and Riley, gotten ourselves involved with the Chamber, Yidinji Chamber of Commerce, after becoming citizens at Yidinji. And we wanted to see, we believed in everything, and we still believe very much in everything that is being forwarded in this wonderful nation. And as we were working with the chamber, what we discovered was that there was a missing in conversation. And in talking with the education minister, Yerilam, that became very transparent what was missing, which is the link, the cultural conversations. Fast-tracking a few weeks after that, what took place was my husband, Riley, drove with Uncle Bhumi, Kalna, further down south, where he, as a diplomat, was working to bring a treaty to existence, which has occurred. And in that process, that joining and that coming together brought the conversations further into there needs to be a cultural chamber of some nature. So when he came back and we brought this up, speeding it up, somehow I've ended up becoming president of the cultural chamber. And I'm very happy to do that because I've had a lot in my previous life of being somebody who's been involved in the sciences. I've been involved in business practices. I've been involved in running the arts. And I've given a lot to thinking about how and why the world is the way it is. And I firmly believe it's because we miss culture. We do not have a link, a cord that, you know, people talk of morality, but actually morality isn't where it starts. It's actually how is our culture that we embody and live that governs our morality, that tells us, it brings about our consciousness, that tells us we're off the path and we need to come back onto the path. And that encompasses your health, it encompasses education, environment, which includes your building practices and how what you live in and how you interact with the land, the earth, the air, the water, the animals, the trees, and with people, as well as the arts and agriculture, the food you eat, where it comes from, how far has it traveled to get to you, all of those conversations is culture. And right now we don't have that. So it makes for us wanting to move forward as a nation. We need that.
Yes, it's a very important part of the government because I think for people who are, let's say, born Yidinji or Jabbagai, Konganji, all Wajambara, Malambara, Gimawalabara, those things are obviously taught at home, and people know the names of places. A majority of people, have a strong sense of culture and identity and law. Mm-hmm. But for a majority of our Yidinji citizens who may not be born here but have moved and lived here, this is an important place to learn about the food, like you said, architecture, the types of things, the language that's used here, the various clan groups and who are the major families. All those things are really important. And I think it's wonderful because it is really for the world to come through that chamber to experience who's who in the zoo when it comes to people living up this way.
Yeah, 100%. It also gives opportunity for those who have come through that haven't been born or are steeped into the culture here to learn, as you just said, but also to bring their skills and be part of that, where they might be not from here, but they might be a cultural elder at the end of the day, eventually, in some form or other. Not necessarily an elder in the scope of an elder, but somebody who is very knowledgeable, who has that, so that the next generation will have far more of a grounding, so we're not taken off the mark. It has given me the scope to realize that I've had to take a step back and really watch how we actually interact, because we interact right now in an economic world, and as an economic world, everything we do is based on how much you can make or how much you are going to spend. And we don't actually think of what we're doing to ourselves to build that economic world. And I think we need to reverse that and go, how are we doing now to build our economic world by bringing the cultural to drive it?
I remember the day that you sat down with Bumi, who's also the Cultural Affairs Minister, and your conversation you met with Yurilim as well, connecting education, culture, is such an important combination. And the economics, you're saying, these are the things that do build economies. Because if you look at the UN system, it sort of reverses that. Like, they do talk about culture a lot, but when I look at it, it's more monoculture than anything. It's just all cultures serve one purpose.
Well, this is what has become. It's, you know, we can label it the Western culture, but I'd like to label it the computer technological culture right now. We rely on Google as God. We've forgotten that we actually have us, ourselves. We can sit on our land and we can listen. We've forgotten how to read the landscape or interact from the heart versus from, as you just put it, that monoculture. And it's driven by GDPs, and it's driven by currency, and it's driven by how big your house is and which new car you bought and which new phone you've got in your hand versus who are you learning from and what are you sharing and what are you imparting to the next individual, whoever the next individual you meet on the street is. So education is a big component, because education is not just, and people assume education is what people learn in school or in university. Education is an ongoing process through your life. But education also includes the law, it includes medicine, it includes, so what are the foods to eat, it includes how you live in this body of yours to bring it to its best form, so yes, your health. So education is a huge component of the culture.
And what I like is that you mentioned about the elders and stuff, is that these are living libraries. Even to the point where some of the younger people do have this knowledge about being digital natives. They can provide and use that technology to actually put culture at the forefront to show the rest of the world. So, you know, you may have some sort of cultural information that's available in German or French or Chinese languages and things like that. And young people can help make those things come to... but there's a combination of all the society. So the elder has the, some information, and sometimes that could be a story place or how to weave or what bush plant to use for this and that. And that's when everything falls apart and there's no internet, these are the things you need to rely on, because there might be a time when that happens. And, you know, I think it's always cultures there to protect and for longevity purposes. And this is why this chamber is quite an important piece of the puzzle, I think.
I think it's a very big, very, very important piece of the puzzle. Thank you for saying that, Murumu. It is a case that if we don't step into and build a new culture by actually embracing the old culture and learning from it, we will inadvertently fall back on what we know, which hasn't actually served us, and it's bringing a demise to the society we live in. So it's a conscious creation. Binanga Gidinji is a consciously being created by the elders. They've given permission. This is moving forward. We're going to bring about a link to the elders of the region and the nation, so that we can actually work with them and then work with the administration of the government and the Chamber of Commerce, Gidinji Chamber of Commerce, to build a sustainable, really, and I don't like that word, but it's a fair word to use here.
Well, it serves this part of the world for thousands of years, so I think it's the longevity is there. It's proven track record, so why not reinvigorate it and use that as the model, like you said, rather than the Western model. I think there are benefits in both sides, and there can be some sort of, you know, culture's always changing. But what I find is that this will help clarify where the information is coming, who is it coming from, as opposed to other information that's coming from Europe or Africa or wherever else. So it will have a specifically unique flavour to this region.
100%. And it's so clear from what you're saying that we're not saying not to bring your culture. Everyone has a culture they've come from, whether you've come from Germany, myself, I've been here, but I was born in Malaysia originally. Those cultures, I've got experience having traveled the globe 3 times over and worked with people from all over the place and experienced communities in all these different areas where we can embody and bring it together. The missing for me has always been that we don't do that because we're so fast-paced, living in a world where we cannot stop to just register where we are at. So it's very, very important that what we're doing at Binanga Yidinji is bridging that gap. And as time goes along, giving us the scope to build it to such an extent that the economy, the administration, and there's a free flow between the economy or the Chamber of Commerce and the economy of Yidinji and the cultural, that it reflects in itself where there will be abundance in every aspect of the world we're living in versus right now the current state where there is scarcity, where we have a few that have a lot and a lot that don't have a lot. So, yeah.
The emblem for the actual organisation is interesting. It's got a tree with some stars surrounding it. When you sat down with Bumi and explaining that, what was he saying about that, the symbolism behind that in terms of culture?
Well, it's the Gimoy tree, so it is the fig tree, and which is representative of the area that we're in. It is also where law is made, so the elders will come together to sit under it, and they discuss culture, they discuss everything that's going on. It is something I have been familiar with for my own self, coming from heritage-wise, coming from India and Sri Lanka. So it's also something that's very familiar to me because I've heard of stories where the elders of the family would sit and the community would sit and do that. So very similar. So this emblem is basically about sitting, being able to create together, coming together. It's about building community, but it's about freedom. And under that scope, it's also about having all these arms, whether it's health, education, arts, environment, agriculture, come together under one tree with the roots that go into the earth, then transfers up through the body of the tree and its trunks, out to its arms and out onto, literally out into the skies, filling our airspace.
What I like about it also is that the fig tree is quite common in, for example, in the Bible, it talks about the fig tree quite often, and these things are very important. And trees represent kingdoms, and there's all the symbology there that I really enjoy. But I think it's going to be exciting because the elders are the ones that will benefit from it, because I think one of the hardest thing is that, like, it doesn't matter which nation you talk to, the elders are always concerned that the transfer of knowledge is being hindered because it is a fast-paced world, it is a dog-eat-dog world, and like you said, people just don't have the time to sit, listen, learn, and hold those things of value. And I think for someone who's getting older, like even with my son, for example, I have a limited time to pass on everything I think that is important for him to live a good life, let's say. So you can imagine what's on the minds of the elders when they see, you know, these developments of spaceships and things like that. And these are really complex things that are being put into the world now, and in the last 100 years, the technology has absolutely changed, the world's changed. But as we keep coming in, the culture is the foundation of identity and the nation, and that's what this is coming to reinforce and put the elders, not that they were demoted, but put them at the forefront of everything we do here.
I think one of the things that has occurred in our society is we've forgotten the elders. I don't think they were demoted. I think we turned them into aged care individuals that needed to be put aside because they can't actually be of any benefit because they have nothing really to give. My husband's, we've just come back, but my husband's grandfather, who has just turned 100 years old, I mean, he's completely sound of mind. His body is not 100%, but we went for his birthday. And I see it amazing in the fact that he could be there with his whole family. Now, even with that, I found the interactions, even though they were there and they were doing everything and they celebrated his life and they celebrated him, I still found he wasn't contributing fully. And I actually found sadness in that, because every individual, the next generation, after that, has just over the time space forgotten that he lived this life and he's had this world of experience that he could have shared or can share with others. And they adore him and love him. So I think to myself, wow. And I did. I had the moment thinking, wow, how would it be for those who actually just get put in aged care facility and they're forgotten about, or they're put in a... They're told they're not required because everything you need to do and have is already in existence on the internet. So why bother? You don't need anything else. So overall, yes, you're right. It is a case of the elders coming back into forefront, and it's spoken language. It's not just written language that needs to be remembered, because when you speak, you have power over your world, your existence, because you've created it. Add to that the fact that once you start having your elders actually be able to share their story, share their life, you're going to encourage the next generation or even a number of generations to start getting interested in what their world was or looked like, or what their world could be like, versus an absolute, this is what it is, there is no interaction, you don't have any part to play in it, you just keep living your life as set by the dogma. We're not here for that. We're here to create something newly.
And what is exciting is there's so many things that this could lead to in terms of a national archive, for example, for families from the area. So one of the things that I find quite common listening to people talk is that they'll share their story, but it's being controlled in Canberra, for example, and you've got to go through all this red tape to access your grandmother's language or your grandfather's story, whereas here it will be kept in trust for that particular reason, for families to go back to and listen or have a copy, but make sure that we're looking after it, mm-hmm. and it doesn't go missing or someone else takes it and doesn't share it or whatever it may be in the future. So there's a number of positives from that. I think that's one of the things that are quite exciting, is a national archive, a living histories centre in the future. So these are some of the things that may have popped in your mind. How do you see this in 20 years' time, let's say?
We were just talking about this today. I was talking to Mama Davy from the Yidinji Chamber of Commerce today. What is it all going to look like in 20 years' time? It's something we haven't actually spent a lot of energy yet. But if I step into my world 20 years from now, so it's sitting in 2043... and what this world, or what our world with what we've got looks like. Well, for a start, we speak the language. We know it. We interact with it because we've remembered who we are in that space. you're right, the National Archive, there's stories available for the families to come that are from their perspective, families that want to come, that is not just available to all unless the family gives permission directly to say, yes, we would like to share this with others. So it's not something they have to go all the way to Canberra to do because it's not required. It's here for them. We've got paintings and artwork and movement that has occurred in the arts world that has influenced every fabric of how we exist. There is building structures that's a demonstration of integration to the landscape and has brought about housing that is made available for all, not just for a few, but for all around us that can make the land. And the land is regenerated because people are actually thinking about not just creating a food that's for protection, but it's creating a landscape which is actually about all, which is the animals, which is us, which is, it is inclusive. It is not exclusively you're trying to protect something. It's about creating something. So it's growing. The landscape is growing. The waters are cleaner. We find ourselves happier overall. I know it sounds utopian, and I'm not saying there won't be struggles and that you don't have to deal with yourself. There's always going to be that. But an education system that allows you the authority to be having that struggle and doesn't make you wrong is a big component of what will be in existence at that point in time.
And that brings an end to the show. That was Krishna Sangrapillay, the president of the Chamber of Culture, there speaking. Ganyara, some final comments before we head off today.
Yeah, look, ultimately the truth has to come out. The truth of the matter has to come out of how Australia got here, what happened to us, how did we claim to be getting inside Australia, did they really allow us in properly? No, they didn't. So the truth of the matter is coming out there. Actually, the Yirrkala Commission sat recently again about the dispossession of the land. There was a really interesting show last year about how Victoria Police acknowledged that the Aboriginal people's sovereignty still exists and that they were an oppressed people. And, you know, this is all the forms of international crime, but we've got to sort this mess out. And that's why the Chamber of Culture is brought about, to try and put the truth out. We've got to put the truth out there for people to understand. They can come along and listen. And then once you've got an understanding of what happened, the truth of the matter, then you can sort of say, OK, well, I want to be an active part in resolving the problem, what was just talked about, you know, the oppression, the dispossession, whatever it may be. But we've got to work together on this as one human lot.
That's exactly right. I think people generally are interested in what is true and what is just. And these institutions that we're building in terms of the Chamber of Commerce, the Chamber of Culture, are really vital instruments of the Yidinja Nation to help provide that that gap in terms of the bridging the gap. A lot of our citizens are, let's say, white fellas. It's because it's their connection to country. It really does give them some sort of a connection that is real, and they want to be part of something that's true and just. And the Yidinja Nation is all about that. And that's why I think it's really important that we continue to create these other organs of government and to really promote that Yidinja name. And that's heading overseas. You know, recently I spoke with Paul McCartney's sister, for example, about Yidinja via Zoom and stuff, and they're very excited about it. They're excited because the old legacy world is it's sort of decaying right in front of everyone's eyes, and they want something that's a bit more real, a bit more tribal or connected to the land, a bit more firm in the foundation. And that's the Yidinja story. And not because of you and me, but because of everyone, the elders, the families, even the ones that live off territory. You know, they carry this story with them, and that's something that's beautiful, Ganyara.
It really is. Look, it's not just a blackfella show. This is a blackfella, a whitefella, yellowfella. It doesn't matter what colour you are. We're all humans on this place together. And that's something that most people don't realise because it's an adversarial world out there. We're all in this together. You know, I had a conversation only last week with a academic about the three-part Australian test for Aboriginality. And he said, that is so wrong. It is so wrong because it brings in race into something that's Australian law, a colonial manifestation. He says, so wrong. Don't, you know, that's something that's